Kenosha Sports Extra, the podcast, bringing back our good friend, the voice of reason, VOR. Welcome back to Kenosha Sports Extra.
Hey, how's everybody doing on this awesome podcast evening?
Podcast evening. Now, we've gone back and forth, and I've always kind of treaded lightly on how to break in the new batch of listeners to what exactly the voice of reason is and what exactly the voice of reason does. And considering that you and I neither know nor try to figure out what that is, we just kind of let it roll and take our chances. But we've been having some fun kicking around the idea of things like symbolism in movies. And I was actually just recording the piece with Rick Limpert, and he was talking about magic socks. So the first thing I'm thinking of is, well, they got to be for Lieutenant Dan, because as we all know, Lieutenant Dan has magic legs. So, and he said that that happened to be the second Forrest Gump reference that he had of the day. So sometimes you kind of take the movie gods or the sports gods for what they are. And you wonder if that was the, you know, if we were in full blown, let's break down a movie, you would have to just throw aside any prep work and go straight to Forrest Gump, because that's what the, it is the will of the gods. Just talking about movie symbolism in general is kind of fun. And one of our friends had posted on Facebook something about a Seagal movie and how he could break down the Seagal movie and everything that it meant to whom and what and where, or pick Weird Science, or, you know, The Godfather, pick any movie, and the symbolism is pretty deep, and it's fun to kind of pick apart. And it's also fun when two relatively intelligent people who've seen the same movie multiple times also have the ability to see completely different symbolism as well. So that being said, give me your take on does every movie go in trying to tell an underlying story, or are there still movies out there that just kind of slap it in your face and say, here it is?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. And, you know, let's start with, you know, the fact that it's an art form, like making movies, acting in movies. It's a depiction of real life, right? We've all used the Star Wars analogy that, you know, it's other galaxies and blowing up the Death Star. But it's all real people. It's real life. Like, human beings created that. And it's nothing more than an extension of who we are as a people and how we think. And the analysis and breaking down of movies is super powerful. Like, it's very, very close to people. When you talk to people about music, they have strong opinions about that. And remember, your opinion can't be wrong. I mean, we could obviously Google it if you were talking something factual based, but if it's your opinion and a certain scene or a certain actor really moves you, then it does. Like, and you want to defend that and you want to explain that. And I know we've had a lot of fun over the years of just throwing out a name and saying, like, Tom Cruise. Well, to different people, Tom Cruise is different people. You may know him as one of the characters that he played. So there's kind of a default character, like an Al Pacino. You mentioned Godfather. Like, who is he to you, and what does he represent? And of course, whichever character or whatever movie is your favorite is really kind of a window into your soul as well.
And staying with Al Pacino, it's like, I think of three right off the top. Obviously, The Godfather, just racked with symbolism. But a very under-the-radar movie that a lot of people have never seen is Dog Day Afternoon, which is also incredibly powerful and also completely racked with symbolism. And then Scent of a Woman. It's like, you know, the hoo-ha. And it's like, man, do you think it takes a specific type of actor or actress or whatever they wish to be called these days to pull off massive symbolism? Would it be as much in the writing as it is in the acting, the delivery, as much as it is in the message?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a combination of all of those things. Like, a great actor cannot carry a horrible script, and a horrible actor can absolutely brutalize a perfect script. So, and that's another fun thing to do when you're breaking down movies. I'm sure a lot of people have heard the, like, what Will Smith was supposed to be Neo in The Matrix, and what if it wasn't Keanu Reeves, and some of these what if scenarios, like if that person would have played it. Wyatt Earp is a classic one, when you got Tombstone versus Wyatt Earp, and of course Doc Holliday, and like you got your Kurt Russell versus your Kevin Costner, and a lot of people in the movie world would pick Kevin Costner over Kurt Russell, but when it comes to playing Doc Holliday, very often they'll pick Kurt Russell because of his depiction in the movie Tombstone.
Talking to the voice of reason about movie symbolism and things of that nature, and it's kind of funny, I was just, you know, we're talking about, you know, are we going to do something with movies and how much they mean to everyone, and I'm telling you what, dude, the last 4, 5, 6, 8 minutes of My Cousin Vinny was on again last night, and I went on record of saying that Annie Savoy was my number one all-time favorite female character in movie history. And I think I've had to just redo that to a 1 and 1A and say Mona Lisa Vito has got to be right there. But again, another movie where, you know, the entire movie, all she wants to do is help him, and all he wants to do is push her away and say, no, you can't help me. I'd love to, but you can't. And then by the time it all comes full circle, he's alienated her so much that she would do anything to get out of that Alabama town, and that's when he needs her the most, and literally pulls her into the courtroom, asks her if he's wrong, knowing full well she's smart enough to know that he's wrong, but in proving him wrong, also proves his case. I mean, you got kids, I got kids, and let me tell you what, there are many times where about the time you figure you've asked for the last time and you've done about all there is to do and you're about at odds with whatever child you're battling with, and about that time you're about ready to say, all right, we're going to, you know, put this whole thing on an iceberg and float it out in the middle because you can't chew the leather no more, and all of a sudden, boom, it all switches around, and if you were down, all of a sudden you feel up about things. And if you're feeling good about things, yeah, just wait a second, and the kick in the stones is coming. So, you know, I think you can almost interpret the way the end of that particular movie goes in any one of about 15 million ways, whether it be parent-child, whether it be relationship, whether it be boss-employee. I mean, it really depends kind of, I think you might agree, that your symbolism is going to come out of it based on where you are in your own life.
Absolutely. Your own perspective is what you choose to see. There is no doubt about it. We've talked about chess very often. You know, some people literally see 64 squares and a bunch of pieces. They literally don't know how they move. All the way to a grandmaster who sees 20, 30 moves deep and an unbelievable memorization of the board. And literally, they're both looking at the same thing, and no different in the arts, where somebody could say, I think this is a very poor movie, they really missed the boat, and the person sitting next to you is riveted. It reminds them of somebody in their family that may have passed away or motivated them or made a difference for them, or that coach that really believed in them. Like, it's, again, it's all about people and stories about people, and the audience is people. So the whole thing is about trying to get in touch with things that matter. Like, really, when you think about these amazing trilogies, or of course even further into 7, 8, 9 of the same characters and the same idea, it's because you've fallen in love with these characters. You love, you want to know what they do and where they go, and how many people have rewritten scenes or ending to movies and say, hey, this is what I think should have happened, this would have been way better.
talking to the voice of reason about symbolism in movies, and I'm going to ask you if you have one that comes to mind, and in order to give you a second or two to kind of give it some thought, I'm going to talk about the one that I thought was always the most powerful one, and again, The Godfather, which is obviously a number one type movie for me, but it's like the entire movie, it is obviously well documented that no one in the family, including and most importantly the Don, wants Michael to have anything to do with the family business. You know, hey, what are you going to do? You can't shoot him across from 500 yards away. You got to go up and you got to ba ba ba. You know, and you know, everybody's just, yeah, Mikey, go do this. And, you know, we're not talking family business with you around. And I mean, that's just very much the underlying theme that, you know, they're trying to go legitimate and they want Michael out of it. They want him to be the first one, Senator Corleone, maybe even President Corleone. And then when the Don gets capped and he's laying in the hospital and you know, they pull the guards and Michael happens to be there when nobody's there. And he pulls the Don and he pulls his bed and he kind of has it in the back room. And then he goes and talks to Enzo the baker and gets him ready to go outside and pretend like he's got a gun. But the moral of the story is the Don's laying in the new room kind of hiding. And he's just kind of groggy and half-assed, and he looks up at Michael, and Michael just basically said, I'm with you now, Pop. Now, you could say that, okay, you're cool because I'm not going to let anybody shoot you here. That's got nothing to do with it. I'm with you here, Pop, is I'm here. I'm all in. I got no choice. Somebody else made my choice for me. You know, you guys did your best to keep me shielded from this thing, but It's me and you in this hospital, and right now the only thing that matters is blood, and blood is thicker than anything else, and even though you'd love for me to be on the straight and narrow and I'm your ticket to legitimacy, right now I happen to be your ticket to staying alive, so I'm here, I'm with you now, Pop. And to me, at one time I talked to an ardent Godfather fan who was just, you know, certain he knew everything there was. And to me, that was kind of the climax of the movie. I mean, yeah, of course, there's a million different things. But I mean, if you talk about the structural setup of a book or a movie, you know, you got your introduction, you got your this, you got your that, and then it kind of peaks out where it's going to peak out, and then it kind of eases off. Well, there's no guarantees that the, you know, the bang for your buck part of the movie, the watershed moment part of the movie, is going to be at the end of it. There's nothing that says that's the case. To me, when Michael said, I'm with you now, Pop, that meant that to me was like everything that had been building up to that was, how do we keep Michael out of this thing? And Michael's now in this thing. So that's my long-winded version of something that I saw as humongous symbolism that a person who makes me look like an amateur for how many times they've seen it, they think I'm full of crap.
Excellent, excellent. I would probably reach towards Batman Begins, if everybody remembers Christian Bale taking over early Batman. Absolutely one of my favorite movies to this day. And early in the movie, he obviously has a major role in causing his parents' death. He deals with a lot of guilt as a kid. And then he runs into Ducard, who is Liam Neeson, and he basically trains him how to be Batman. Of course, at the time, you don't know that he's actually, spoiler alert, he's actually the bad guy. But he trains him, and he says, hey, like, I see your anger. I mean, you're angry that, you know, your parents were killed. I get that, but that's just simply getting in the way. It isn't really anger that drives you. It's fear. What do you fear? What inside of you is causing you to be governing your life based on anger? And really, that's just a charade. No offense to your parents, but you being mad that they got killed is just a charade for the fact that you're simply afraid. So let's dive inward. We can't go kill Joe Chill. We can't kill the guy that killed your parents. That doesn't matter. That's not going to solve your inner demons. It's your fear. And of course, when he does finally make it up the mountain with the blue flower, and he immediately walks in, and Liam Neeson just starts kicking his ass. And he's like, whoa, I'm exhausted. I just made this long trip. And he's like, yeah, you know, death is not kind. Death is not going to wait till you're ready. It's going to come at you at all directions, at all time. And of course, the climax was when Liam Neeson gets right in his face and looks at him and says, oh, you're definitely afraid, just not of me. I don't know what you're afraid of, but you're definitely not afraid of me. And we are going to train you all day, every day, till you are ridiculously exhausted and so talented that you can get past your fear, get past your anger, and do something good with your talents instead of being all trapped up inside.
Talking to the voice of reason about movie symbolism, and it's been an interesting movie season. You don't even know what movie season is anymore. I mean, we've been talking about the fact that Tinseltown here in town, I think for $40, you can get you and 12 of your closest friends and go have Tinseltown show Caddyshack or something. But, you know, it was weird because, like, pre-virus time, movies were kind of like, you know, they were scheduled. They were, you know, they were an option. They were a date. They were a lot of things. And like me personally, like going to see Joker by myself was just an awesome thing because A, I know nobody in my house would really be interested in going with me. And B, as much as I've never really been I'm going to go to the restaurant and have a lunch by myself or, you know, I've never vacationed by myself, but to be able to go to a movie and not have to ever talk to anybody, to not have to have distractions, to be able to sit kind of off the beaten path, knowing full well, even pre-virus, that nobody was really going to be overly near me, hopefully not have to deal with anybody's cell phone dinging or ringing or whatever the case may be. And to be able to kind of dig my head into that dark-ass movie was really fun. And it just seems like now, I mean, I don't know, we may be closer to it today than we were yesterday. We may be 100 miles away from it. But, you know, as much as you wonder about the legitimacy of the folks that run Hollywood sometimes, what they produce is still kind of a pretty necessary thing. And you know, you hope that people can see them for what they are, hopefully use them as a tool to maybe go so far as to do some explanations, maybe relieve some pains, whatever the case may be. You just hope it doesn't go too far to where you're just sitting there staring at a screen and taking everything 100% at face value. And I guess there are people who do that, and I'm not here to judge them. I just sure as hell know I'm not that person.
Yeah, we definitely talk about straightforward action, chase scene, entertainment type of movies, which would, of course, would be kind of the opposite spectrum of a lot of depth, a lot of psychology, a lot of meaning. And we've talked about that, you know, obviously with social media and the on-demand world that we live in, kind of the nature of ESPN, like we don't need to watch 27 minutes of stuff we're not interested in to catch the 3 minutes we wanted to see. Now we can just not only go to the 3 minutes, but go to it immediately and just bypass all the rhetoric. So very similar in the world of movies. It feels like, you know, the Netflix and the Amazon Prime contracts that people are signing, actually direct to video type of thing in these days, are actually probably more quality than the grandiose movie production of $200 million that we've known in the past.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you know, and you know that world a little better than I, and probably not nearly as well as a lot of people do, but I think you see more and more your mainstream big time actors who you would never see do anything but showing up on the silver screen, and they're all over something that you pay for.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we fall in love with these actors, you know, like Denzel Washington comes to mind. I mean, basically, if he's on the screen, I'll give it a shot. Like, I don't even know what the topic is or who he's playing or what his name is. But if you like these people, like I mentioned before, like Tom Cruise, just the major, major players. And I mean, let's face it, those folks are getting old. Like, it always used to seem that it'd be a new crop of just the future of big time acting. And I think that's waning. And I hope that's not a dig on the current folks, but you're just not seeing the up and coming people that you just gravitate towards. And you'll, again, back in the day, you'd say, hey, I'll give you $4 of my money. I'll just give it a shot. And now when going to the movie is like $57 a person, you know, you're like, hey, I'm just not going to carte blanche, just go on a date, buy popcorn and a drink. We're dropping $500 to see a substandard movie.
All right. So I mentioned that Annie Savoy and Mona Lisa Vito are my 1 and 1A. And I will not hold you to this because I haven't given you sufficient prep time. But if you had to come up with a voice of reason, number one all-time favorite female actor in a movie, who you got?
Whew, yeah, that would be tough. Yeah, I would definitely have to give that one some thought. But the first one, one of my all-time favorite movies that certainly didn't get the reception but is a top tenner for me, is an obscure movie called The First Knight. Richard Gere, Sean Connery plays King Arthur, and Lady Guinevere in that movie was a hit back then named Julia Ormond. And the way Julia Ormond plays Lady Guinevere in that movie, that is one of the most symbolistic movies of all time. And very often do I watch it and just break it down to the ridiculous. That happens to be what I love to do. And I love going back and forth with what other people think certain things could mean. And the way she plays that character, I know she was really big in the early, mid, late 90s, and then really kind of went away. But her playing Guinevere to Lancelot, Richard Gere, well, the love interest was just unbelievable. She's so tough and so strong, yet so passionate and so loving. She just really knocked it out of the park.
Brother to brother, yours in life and death. I mean, you know, between that, there's something I made for our good friend, the Blade, Steve Hess, at his Memorial Softball Tournament. And then how many times I've quoted, sometimes there is a peace that only can be found on the other side of war. It's like, I don't even know that movie. I just know it through osmosis because you love it so much. But, I mean, sometimes you come across movies like that. It's like Frank Zappa's Zootalures. I knew all the words to all the songs on the album Frank Zappa's Zootalures before I had ever heard it, because Jim Ward sat next to me in basic drawing class as a freshman at St. Joe's and sang it all day. Very similar to First Knight. By the time I had actually begun to watch First Knight, it was almost useless, because not only did I know it from your understanding of it, but it was almost like I couldn't have gotten around what you thought about it if I wanted to. So, you know, there are movies like that that are just stick with it powerful. And as much as I probably would have never come across that movie, it is one that it's like, wow, you could really, really, you know, literally run the gauntlet only to get to the prize. And the prize is a kiss of Guinevere. And instead of being able to claim your prize, to go through a gauntlet that no one else can touch, your answer is, I can't, because I only have one heart to lose. It's like, get out of town.
Yeah, and the strength of movies like that, like off movies, I think, you know, if we were to do in-depth analysis, we would want to introduce the audience to movies they're probably unfamiliar with, and that if they would dive in, that they would be absolutely elated. So yes, it's kind of almost easy to take the mainstream movies that everybody has an opinion about, but you know, let's do an average poll of, let's just randomly interview 100 people and how many of them have ever seen the movie Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Exactly. And it's like, I've talked to people about that, and of the people that do know, they're like, oh yeah. And the people that don't know, and then you rattle off who's in it, and they're like, what? How have I never heard this? What? And then, you know, that one's loaded with the cast of characters, but then there's other ones that you just get lucky and find a dude I know who's kind of got his foot in the film industry, and you know some people and know some things. He's like, dude, you got to check out this movie called Cheap Thrills. And I actually saw it free on YouTube and watched it. And it was the dude who plays Champ in Anchorman. It's the dude that plays Papa Giorgio in Vegas Vacation. And it's the dude that was, what was the series about crack? Breaking Bad, that dude. So it was like those three dudes before anybody really knew much of who they were and all this kind of stuff. And it's just a goofy, crazy, can't take your eyes off, who the hell knows what's going to happen next type movie that I just absolutely stumbled across.
Yeah, that is a great point. You know, all from the Hollywood blockers all the way to the diamond in the rough, the ones that you know you don't even really know. And when you get past just the initial message, I often reference like Men of Honor. You know, obviously if you start throwing out Cuba Gooding Jr. and Robert De Niro, like, you know, it's gonna raise everybody's eyebrows, like, you know, whoa, these are like mainstreamers. But when you get into the story of Carl Brashear and the first African American Navy diver and what he had to go through, the barriers that he had to experience and the outward blatant racism that he had to overcome to do something that in that current stage that he was in was just simply not possible. And the way that they pulled that off and that relationship really transcends just the actors themselves.
Voice of Reason talking about movies and symbolism in movies. So, what's our action item? Do you think it's better to go to start out with the idea of symbolism in a movie that most people have seen, just to give ourselves some half-ass legitimacy to say, why on earth would I ever want to listen to what these two buffoons have to say again? So you'd have to almost pick something that you know at least a decent amount of people have seen. It's like, you know, I'm not going to roll out with some of these that folks seen, but talking about movies that a lot of people have never seen, that's loaded with characters that you and I stumbled across down in my basement with Sleepers. I mean, you know, that dark movie, it's like, God, you watch that movie and it sucked. It was so good. And it's like, golly, and you could pick that thing apart 7 ways till Thursday, but unfortunately there ain't enough people that have probably seen it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, and then you could get all the way to the jokesters as well. Like, absolutely one of the greatest movies ever made is Roadhouse, Patrick Swayze. And that movie gets jeered at. It gets laughed at about how hokey and how, like, it's one of the worst movies ever made. And it's like, boy, I really think if you were to sit down and watch that movie with us and do a podcast about the depth and the analysis of what you're actually seeing. Okay, yeah, he pulls people's throats out and he's tough. I get it. That's really cool. But that literally doesn't make the top 1,000 things in that movie if you were to break it down. So, yeah, I would agree. A little bit more mainstream, one that, you know, that people are familiar with and that they would have an opinion about. And then we drill down and get a little bit of depth. We could actually put it out to the folks and say, hey, what, vote for a couple of movies that you would like to hear on a podcast that we were to break down. And then you can evaluate for yourself. What do you feel? And as a matter of fact, if you colossally disagree with us, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Throw it in the chat box and talk to us about how much you disagree with our breakdown, and that's actually just as valuable as people who agree.
He's arguing. He's making an argument. Voice of Reason, good stuff as usual. This was fun and enlightening. I think we have something here, and I just thought it would be best today if we just kind of talked this thing out together, and I think we came up with some pretty good ideas and some pretty good action items. So I'm going to noodle around a little bit and see what I can find out. Maybe bring in Gary Schneeberger, who said he could write an entire dissertation on the pool scene in Hard to Kill. So anybody who can do that is all right in our book. But yeah, this was fun. It'll be interesting to break it down.
Yeah, good stuff. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we could go Steven Seagal versus Van Damme all night long. Awesome. Thanks for having me. Have a great week.
All right. Take care.